This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, November 3rd. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Last week, when Megyn Kelly interviewed Newt Gingrich on her Fox News show, he accused her and other journalists of giving undue attention to the charge that Donald Trump is a sexual predator.
What I said is, if Trump is a sexual predator, then it's a big story. And what we saw on that tape was Trump himself saying that he likes to grab women by the genitals and kiss them against their will.
You are fascinated with sex and you don't care about public policy.
Me?
Now, that's
really
what I get out of watching you tonight.
You know what, Mr. Speaker? I'm not fascinated by sex, but I am fascinated by the protection of women and understanding what we're getting in the Oval Office. And I think the American voters would like
and
to
know. And therefore, we're going to send Bill Clinton back to the East Wing because, after all, you are worried about sexual predators.
Yeah, listen, it's not about me. It's about the women and men of America. And the poll numbers show us that the women of America in particular are very concerned about these allegations and in large part believe that they are a real issue. And
you want to
don't
comment,
dismiss
you want to comment
the women
on whether the Clinton
summarily.
Rebecca Solnit joins me today, less than a week before the election, to discuss the possibility that in large numbers, the women of America will be avenging themselves on Donald Trump in the voting booth. Welcome, Rebecca.
Lovely to be with you.
This is beginning to get out there a little bit, this idea that Donald Trump could turn out to be a gift to women, you know, sparking a really a significant shift in how the country thinks about sexual assault and male entitlement. Do you agree with that?
I do to some extent, although I sure don't think we should be grateful to him. You know, Hurricane Katrina shifted policy in New Orleans in some meaningful ways, but we don't have to be grateful to the Army Corps of Engineers levees or to hurricanes. Yeah, and what's interesting is that this has become a really common phenomenon, at least since the Isla Vista massacre in May of 2014, which begat the Twitter hashtag explosion, Yes All Women, in which a kind of extraordinary chorus of women sort of appears saying, yes, this is my experience. Yes, this is so. Yes, we need to pay attention to this problem. It's not minor or marginal, and it's not misrepresentation. So we've seen it with domestic violence, with the Ray Rice case, with women tweeting why I stayed and why I left about being involved with abusers. We've seen it with John Gomeshi accused of assaulting a lot of women in Toronto with the hashtag I believe her, and the not okay hashtag that arose from Trump's videotape.
Not to mention Bill Cosby last year.
Oh my God.
And then
he
Clarence
didn't get his
Thomas
own hashtag, but he got his own Greek chorus for sure.
And it's just astonishing. The Clarence Thomas revelation, I think it was just last week, almost got overlooked given everything else that's going on right now in this moment. But yet another woman came forward saying he had groped her in 1999.
And it's so interesting how these women are discredited no matter when they speak up. And they're both told that, I don't believe you, why didn't you speak up earlier? And, of course, the first half of that response explains the second half really well. These things, they really kind of break something. And, you know, it's like breaking a dam and suddenly a torrent of testimony breaks forth. And I think of it as being kind of like the punctuated equilibrium Clarence Thomas used to describe geological transformation, that there's not continuous chaos, there's not a kind of steady, calm state, but there's these moments where something breaks and there's a lot of turbulence and then you arrive at the next state for a while. You know, the last 4 years have seen a lot of punctuated equilibrium as feminism remakes the landscape.
And you've been thinking about this broader subject for a very long time. And I have to say, when I first heard the clip that we just played with Megyn Kelly arguing with Newt Gingrich, it immediately brought to mind a phrase that you popularized that every woman instantly understands: mansplaining. It's been cropping up again a lot this year in newspaper articles and in everyday conversations. Tell us about that and what inspired it.
Well, the word mansplaining was coined by an anonymous woman blogger, I think a woman, who I wish would come forth and take credit, in direct response the week after I originally published the essay Men Explain Things to Me, which I had no idea was going to still be circulating 8.5 years later. I'm mansplaining is the situation that happens way too often where a man assumes he has authoritative knowledge of something that he may be completely ignorant about and the right to explain it to a woman who may, in fact, be an expert on it. I've had women astrophysicists, lawyers, doctors, all kinds of professionals tell me about having men who don't even understand their field explain things to them. And it's an everyday occurrence where something about life under patriarchy makes them so overconfident they assume they're qualified to speak and they assume we're only qualified to listen when it's often very much the other way around.
Remind us of the original incident that inspired you to write your essay.
If we get to my actual life, my life, like most women's life, has been an endless cascade of mansplaining misadventures. But the epic, glorious, ridiculous example that let me really make my case came when a friend dragged me to a weird fancy party in Aspen in 2003. And the guy there said in this very patronizing way, "And what are your books about?" And I said, "Well, the most recent one is about Edward Muybridge." And he cut me off to tell me about the very important book about Edward Muybridge that had come out that year that I should know about, a book he hadn't actually read but had read the New York Times review of but had not noted was by a woman named Rebecca Solnit. And he was so eager to explain to me about this very important book I should know about, he couldn't hear my friend interjecting four times before he finally shut up. "That's her book. That's her book." You know, it's sort of both annoying and gratifying, but it's gratifying when a chronic problem is suddenly so overt and obvious and, you know, it can become something completely hideous. And we were just talking about sexual assault. Lack of credibility is why a lot of women don't come forward and are not believed, come forward and are mocked and punished. And so, you know, credibility and the sort of gravitas our survival tactics. In that original essay, I was surprised as I wrote it to realize that I wasn't writing about kind of amusing incidents in which men explain things to me, that in fact it was a slippery slope and that the same set of assumptions about his right to determine meaning, her lack of right to do so or even to speak or protest plays out as rape, as lack of credibility to testify about abuse of power and crime and et cetera, and that it's, you know, ended up being the whole gestalt of gender politics at its most nightmarish as well.
Let's get back for a second to the campaign itself. I came across in one of the many notorious Hillary Clinton emails, one of them was quoted in a piece by Amy Chozick for the New York Times, where Hillary's talking about why she avoided the issue of gender in her 2008 campaign against Obama. And she said that the research showed that even members of her own party resisted the idea of a female president. And she said they didn't think a woman was qualified, could do the job, didn't see a woman as commander-in-chief. That answered one of the questions that I've had watching this campaign unfold about why she really avoided it in 2008 and the different approach she's chosen this year, helped along, as we've been discussing, incalculably by her bullying opponent.
It is really interesting how different a candidate she seems in 2016 than in 2008. It feels like there's been a big learning curve. But I also think that it's not that she's changed, but the world has changed, that there's a kind of receptivity in this, you know, kind of electrified feminist moment to think about that and to embrace that, really. And the gender gap in voting has become really extraordinary as a divide that's almost like a party divide. And the fact that, well, last time I looked, that there was a 20-point gender gap between male and female support for Trump, you know, is really telling. And, of course, Rebecca Traister's done gorgeous work on how unattached women, single women, are much more liberal than married women. Marriage seems to be very bad for women's political positions. There's something, you know, that men become a contaminant to their progressive, radical positions.
But why, then, do you think so many young women on the left who were carried away by Bernie Sanders even now, after Hillary Clinton has essentially adopted Bernie Sanders' platform, are reluctant to vote for her or refusing to vote for her?
You know, I think that the Sanders campaign was its own bizarre trajectory from utopianism into bitterness for many people. I hear from a lot of people who seem to still be in the primary and that they think Hillary Clinton is the opponent, and the fact that Sanders has endorsed her and that the only other choice is a hyper-misogynist neo-fascist, you know, doesn't enter the conversation. You know, there's so many different people with so many different explanations. I think some people can't let go of the Sanders campaign. Some people have very legitimate complaints about her hawkishness and corporateness and other parts of her record, and don't, as some older women do, see gender as so profound and important a factor that they overlook these other things. And I've had as big a question about why a lot of the smart feminists I know seem to have a very almost one-dimensional assessment of who she is. She's a woman, and now we're not going to talk about the other stuff. And then there is something that we've dealt with for the last couple of decades, which is that a lot of young women have benefited from feminism without really recognizing, you know, what the transformations have been. What happened to Hillary Clinton when she took the bar exam to go to law school? What kinds of, fights that were fought so that it was a lot more normal to be a lawyer, a doctor, a person with power, a person with a voice, a person with rights?
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
No one would dispute that when Barack Obama was elected, it was a huge victory for African Americans. Some now worry, Barack Obama included, that the victory has been more symbolic than real, in, at least in alleviating poverty among African Americans as well as others. Do you think there's a risk that if Hillary Clinton wins, the gains for women will be more symbolic? Will she further catalyze some of this violent rhetoric on the right? What do you think is going to happen?
I think Obama felt tremendously limited, and he's a very cautious man who was trying very hard not to seem like he was a president, you know, who unfairly favored black people. And I think he almost bent over backwards. The bottom line is that Clinton will protect reproductive rights, which are a significant part of women's rights, but far from the whole spectrum. But, you know, my fundamental position is that the power I'm really interested in is civil society power, popular power. One of the things that's been so unfortunate and painful about this election year discourse, like every year, is a tendency to discuss candidates as though they're all powerful and what they're going to do is exactly what they promise or threaten to do. And you can see, for example, with President Obama, that he did not veto the Keystone XL pipeline because he'd suddenly become a radical climate activist. He vetoed it because the climate movement had become so powerful it outweighed the financial interests pushing for the pipeline. Another big example for me has been same-sex marriage rights and other rights, where at best politicians have followed just kind of ratifying as law shifts that we've made in culture. So I really always want to go back to the power that we have. When you look at things like Obama actually tried to close Guantanamo, although the Center for Constitutional Rights and ACLU have done tremendous work on that, there was no great popular movement outweighing the Republican refusal to allow him to do so, and so Guantanamo was not shut down. you know, which is often seen as this very simplistic, Obama didn't shut Guantanamo down. You can just as easily say we didn't shut Guantanamo down by becoming an irresistible force, making it an issue and shifting the public understanding.
One of the problems in our civil society continues to be the reluctance of women to run for office. Do you think in the aftermath of the horror show that has been this election, more women will be tempted to run or discouraged from running?
I don't know. All I can say is I went and voted yesterday, and I had a ballot in front of me like nothing I've ever seen before. I had two choices of women for president. That's never happened, including a candidate who could actually win. I had only women candidates for Senate in a state that's been represented entirely by women senators for more than 20 years, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein. The estimable Kamala Harris is almost certain to succeed Boxer. And then I had Nancy Pelosi will probably continue to represent San Francisco in the House. And then for state senator, the fantastic Jane Kim. California so often is the bellwether for the flock of 50 states. I do wonder, you know, if the rest of the country will go our way.
I want to finish by asking you, Rebecca, a question that feels somewhat tangential, but it's not really, which is about a fantasy subway map of New York City that's featured in your new book, Nonstop Metropolis. It's called City of Women. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
That was a fascinating project. I came up with the idea of doing a subway map where I changed all the names to Great Women of New York. It seemed like a great way to put women's names out there, kind of take stock of all these fantastic women, from tennis champions to Supreme Court justices to labor organizers to hip-hop stars. And what I didn't really understand until I was into the project was that almost every cityscape I've ever been, every city I've ever lived in and visited, is full of things named after men, monuments to men. You know, in New York City, there are boroughs named after men, bridges named after men, tunnels, skyscrapers, just boulevards. Huge percentage of the streets are named after men. You move through what I called in the essay a manscape. And so doing this, I realized, oh my God, I might have had a completely different sense of my own place in the world if I'd moved through a landscape where women were even half of the landscape. And putting out this map, I heard from so many other women that both that the map thrilled and vindicated and excited them in some way to see, you know, this vision of a city in which women were really reflected. But I also heard extraordinary things from them. Two students said to me, well, one of them said that she'd had bad posture all her life. In a city where a lot of things were named after women, she would stand up straight. And it really accounted for the sense that these names, this sense of who has power, who matters, who will remember, who has become great enough to commemorate, goes all the way down into how you inhabit your own body. So, and the second student said, would a man sexually harass me on a boulevard named after a great woman? And I was just staggered to think that maybe even everyday social behavior like that would be altered. And so I think that when we talk about electing enough women that it starts to become normal for women to have power, when we start to allow women to achieve the kind of greatness that Hamilton's and Madison's and Jefferson's and Washington's were allowed, we really change the social landscape in a way that affects all of us in our everyday interactions and how we imagine our own rights and voices, and maybe in how men imagine those things too. So, you know, we have a long way to go. I'm glad we're moving forward.
It's a great note to end on. Thank you so much for joining me, Rebecca.
My pleasure, Dorothy.
Rebecca Solnit, a New Yorker contributor, has published 19 books, most recently Nonstop Metropolis, a New York City atlas, and you can also find the New York City subway map that we've been talking about, City of Women, on newyorker.com, along with an essay that Rebecca wrote for the book. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com or on the New Yorker apps, available at no extra charge from the App Store and Google Play. And you can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The Political Scene is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Duboff for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.